This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In 1968, Michael Hare went to Vietnam to report on the war for Esquire magazine and to write a book. He returned to the States after a year, but his book wasn't completed and published until 1977. That memoir, Dispatches, became one of the most highly regarded books on the war, one of the books that best described the experiences of the young men who were fighting. Hare also wrote the screenplay for the Stanley Kubrick movie Full Metal Jacket, and he wrote Martin Sheen's voiceover narration for the film Apocalypse Now. But he's published very little since Dispatches. He moved to England with his family and hasn't spoken much to the American press about the war. Hare has a new book, his first published novel, called Walter Winchell. It's based on the life of the famous gossip columnist. Winchell became a power broker through his newspaper column and radio broadcasts in the 1940s. The book began its life as a screenplay about Winchell, who Hare describes as the wizard of the American vicarious.
There was no one like him before his time, that he found a way to plug his incredible ambition into a viable a slot in American life that everybody needed, but no one was aware that they needed. The thing that really, I like the shape of his life. I like the shape of that story, the rise and the fall, and the terrific supporting cast of characters, Damon Runyon and Ernest Hemingway and Sherman Billingsley and the Star Club, and New York City at a time when it just seems so attractive and glamorous and simpler than it is today.
Your novel, Walter Winchell, started off as a screenplay.
That's right.
And I think Bob Fosse was supposed to direct it
before he died. That's true.
Why didn't did you try to shop it around after Fosse's death?
No, I didn't. It wasn't really in my hands. It wasn't under my control. There were producers. There was a studio. There was all of that apparatus involved. It wasn't simply that Bob Fosse died. It was that I had written enough of it to know that I was far too attached to the material to just risk it that way to the movies. There were certain creative differences occurring between myself and the producers, but I felt in my heart that what this project had turned into was more an exercise that should be read rather than filmed. I felt more inclined to turn the picture-making process over to the reader.
Walter Winchell was the kind of columnist who could make or break somebody.
He could.
The high points of his career. And he'd sometimes break someone for really vindictive reasons.
Yeah, often.
So he was a celebrity maker. You've just written a novel about him. Does that have any connection at all to your interest in not talking to the press for so many years? Because there were many years, you know, after Dispatches was written, when people were, you know, talking about the book all around the country, but you really shied away from interviews. You shied away from becoming a very public figure yourself.
Yeah, well, I mean, to begin with, there was the fact that people were doing the talking for me. There was also the fact that I had just spent roughly 8 years of my life writing that book and felt that I didn't have much to say. There was also a fear I had that to talk publicly about Dispatches was somehow inappropriate, that it might turn at any moment into a kind of media travesty that I didn't want to involve myself with. And I was a lot more shy in those days than I am now.
Mm-hmm. Michael Hare is my guest, and his new book is a novel called Walter Winchell. You've written a couple of screenplays for Full Metal Jacket.
Yes.
And Apocalypse Now.
Well, I didn't actually write the screenplay for Apocalypse Now. I wrote the voiceover that was used.
The Martin Sheen narration.
That's right. That's right.
Used. Were there any things that you felt could be shown better in a film than could be told on the pages of a book in terms of the Vietnam War?
Well, I take the view that, you know, I'm a writer, so I have a prejudice. You know, I mean, I went to Vietnam in the first place because of the assumption that this was television's war and that was the medium that was going to tell the story. And I believed it wasn't telling the story, that it required writing to tell the story. So I don't know. There sure are a lot of Vietnam films, but very few of them have moved me.
Do you make a point of seeing all the movies about Vietnam and reading all the books?
No, I make a point of not seeing any of them.
Why?
The subject, I can't tell you how the subject has come to, there's a kind of overload. And that goes for the books as well. I'm not obsessed with Vietnam, you know. There are other things that interest me a great deal more. It was a long time ago. I put in a lot of time. I paid a lot of dues. I don't want to keep going back and opening those wounds all over again.
Is that one of the reasons why you moved to England, so that you could kind of get away from the culture of the war?
That did have a lot to do with it. It had a great deal to do with it. To get away from that and to get away from the sort of persistence of the popularity of that book, the peculiar kind of popularity it had.
What do you mean peculiar?
It was intensely felt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people felt strongly about it.
Well, people probably felt that you were telling their story.
I couldn't help but know that they felt strongly about it. I mean, they made me know that they felt strongly about it.
Phone calls, letters?
Yeah. Yeah.
And upsetting it was, ones?
Frequently, yes.
What would be upsetting about that contact?
People calling you up and spilling their guts on the phone, or letters from widows and orphans and, sisters of guys killed in Vietnam. Veterans with more problems than they could even begin to deal with, and assuming that I could be of help when in fact I couldn't.
You know, in dispatches, you wrote that whenever you were asked why did you go to Vietnam, you'd say, blah, 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 report on the war, blah,
yeah,
blah, blah, write a book, as if you were maybe not completely sure yourself. Now that years and years have gone by, are there reasons that you understand more now than you did then?
Sure.
About why you went?
Sure. I mean, I think in many ways I went for the same reasons that a lot of teenage American kids went, you know. I mean, I was older than they were, better educated than they were, let's say more sophisticated than they were, but in certain ways our motives for going there were the same.
Which motives are you thinking of?
Well, this is tough to break down, but it has to do with a certain a ritual American, a passage, courage, testing yourself, going to see it, going to some place really terrible to look at it, look into it.
You've said that when you went to Vietnam, you were on a different frequency from the rest of the journalists who were there. What were you looking for that was different from what they were looking for?
What I like to think of as the long view, you know. I mean, I was looking for internal voices. I was looking for, I wasn't there for news stories, to write the war story, to write about the day-to-day current events of the war. I was there to write the formal story of the war.
When you were traveling with troops, what did you do during battles, during fighting?
Normally, I got as close to the ground as I possibly could, with my head down. There were one or two occasions where there was no choice but to take a weapon.
So you didn't carry a weapon with you?
No, not normally. It was, it was considered sort of a breach of conduct for a journalist to carry a weapon.
Did you ever feel that the soldiers felt that they had to protect you as a journalist?
I don't know how they felt about it, but I felt that they had to protect me. I mean, it's a point I go into in the book where, in effect, they were my guns, you know. They were my armed escort. And it left me with a feeling of enormous obligation to tell a certain kind of truth about what they were going through.
Well, you really gave a sense in Dispatches of the War from a soldier's perspective, and you wrote in their language. I mean, we were talking about how in Walter Winchell you really captured the language that he used and the words that he made up, the slang of his time. And you did that with Vietnam also.
Well, you know, it's my feeling, it has always been my feeling, that language is probably the most powerful thing there is, except maybe for mind. Language is the most potent force in the world, and that all of our troubles really come from bad language, that things are ill-seen and then they're ill-said, and that we walk around with received language coming out of our mouths all the time, secondhand definitions. So I try to be sort of punctilious about my language. I like to keep it close to the bone.
Was there a certain kind of language that you think was formed during the war?
Yes. I mean, there certainly was a complex of American voices that I took away from the place that played in my head for years, echoed, you know, the voice of... was a largely adolescent American voice that had been exposed to such extremities of endurance and horror that it had a strange elegance and nobility about it.
Dispatches and Apocalypse Now were, I think, in terms of like American literary and film culture, the first book and movie to really make the connection between the war in Vietnam and rock music as the constant soundtrack. When did you start to realize the role that rock music had in people's lives who were fighting the war? I mean, I can think of a scene in the beginning of Dispatches where you're talking about how people like took off their ponchos and the smell of like festering flesh came across the air, and you're hearing Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs singing Little Red Riding Hood.
You didn't really have to be an astute social commentator. You know, I mean, it didn't require a Tom Wolfe's eye and ear, because every place you went, there were guys with transistor radios or cassette players, and it was as though, the Vietnam War had been scored by Motown and Phil Spector and the Beatles and Jimi Hendrix, and there was a way in which I came to feel that the war and the music were both coming from the same fountain, you know. The same impulses in the culture and that were in the air were manifesting in this place together. A violence and a kind of a beauty all at the same time.
Are there records that will set you off thinking about Vietnam when you still hear them now?
Only if I hear them by accident. You know, if I programmed a piece of music, it wouldn't have any effect on me. If I'm driving around in the car and a piece of music comes on, you're gone like a rocket, you know. You have no time to defend yourself against that connection. And then it can remind you.
Which records do that to you?
Anything by Jimi Hendrix will do it, you know.
I think it took around 10 years for Dispatches to be published after your return.
Well, it took about 9 years. That's because it took about 8 years to write it.
How come it took so long?
That's a long story, you know. It just took a long time. It took what it took, you know. I was afraid to finish the book.
Why?
I don't know. I don't know. It was some obsessive, retentive, you know, I had some very private, intimate business to go through before I could let that book go.
And is that why you felt so strongly, maybe, too, about putting it behind you once it was done?
That's right.
Uh-huh.
That's right. It's still awkward for me to talk about it.
Right. Well, listen, I appreciate your having
talked about
it. Oh,
it's okay. That's cool, you know.
Michael Hare is my guest, and his book about Vietnam is Dispatches. His new book is a novel called Walter Winchell. Did it take a long time to write Walter Winchell?
No, that was fast. I mean, that was fast, and it was fun. I mean, it gave me a lot of pleasure to write it. I wrote it fast because it seemed to demand to be written quickly, since it's a book that's largely made up of snappy patter and fast, you know, fast exchanges, wise cracks, and the story was in place. Just, you know, certain decisions had to be made about how to move the time around and who to actually make this Walter Winchell figure. You know, who he really was to be in fiction terms, his psychology, his emotional scaffolding.
You know, I think a lot of your readers have wondered how come there haven't been more books by you over the years.
It's because I haven't wanted to publish anything I've written in that time. There was another book in between that was published, but it vanished very, very quickly.
Is it a collection of profiles?
Yes, yeah, sort of. They're sort of extended captions that accompany a set of 48 portraits, paintings.
Have you been writing things that you haven't been publishing, or have
Oh,
you...
yeah, I've been at work on a book for about 8 years, which, by the way, I've abandoned, so...
Oh, why?
Yeah, because it wasn't right. Something wasn't happening that I needed to have happen. That's a sort of intimate work process problem that is impossible to discuss anyway, even if I were able to be more articulate about it. It's sort of an ineffable thing, but... It wasn't right. It wasn't something I wanted to. Something wasn't going on in that book that had to go on in order for me to want to publish it.
Is it very upsetting to have spent several years on a manuscript that then you're going to put aside?
Actually, it's not. I don't know how to tell you. It's very liberating. It frees a kind of energy. It's good to every once in a while do something like that.
Every once in a while?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a, you know, it's sort of like quality control. It's good for you as a writer to know that, you know, this is a piece of work that didn't work, and you don't want it going out with your name on it.
You once said that you modeled your early life on Hemingway.
Well, I mean, that's complicated, but he certainly was a major inspiration for a long time through my adolescence.
What effect did he have on how you lived your life?
I think he had a lot to do with my going to Vietnam, you know. I think I bought that sort of public version of who he was.
And where did that lead you besides Vietnam?
It led me into a kind of a protracted state of breakdown where I was required to rummage through these various pieces and determine for myself what I believed and what I didn't believe. You know, that the after effects of that kind of behavior are not particularly healthy or wholesome or conducive to making good art.
So did you have to figure out, like, how much of your life you were leading in some kind of pose?
Sure, sure. The kind of, you know, it's really the kind of question that rarely comes up in my life anymore, except in the course of interviews, you know. You know, where you're suddenly shining your, you know, in a public way, honking, you know.
Right, and taking your temperature all the time.
Exactly,
yeah.
Your pulse, you know, and how am I doing, you know. And
Well, one more of those questions. Was this whole sense of, you know, like, was this a pose or not? Did that come after you returned from
Vietnam?
Yeah,
it came about 18 months after I returned because I came back high. You know, I came back not only a feeling a kind of survivor's exultation, but with really a very underdeveloped sense of what I had really just been through. With a kind of horrible glamour value among my crowd in New York City, because none of the people I knew in New York even knew anyone who had been to Vietnam. Everyone was talking about it and thinking about it and trying to locate their feelings about it, but it happened that among, you know, 50 or 60 people in New York, I was the only one who had actually been there.
What changed after the 18 months?
Well, friends of mine began dying in Vietnam. I began to unfreeze certain feelings that had remained frozen from the day I arrived in Vietnam. And I began to make a kind of life or death search for the language to write this book in.
You know, in some ways, I think Dispatches helped define what the language would be in the future to describe Vietnam. And it was one of the first books that really had a big impact. And I mean, for years, as we all remember, there weren't many books or movies that really came to terms with.
But, you know, it's, I mean, it's very strange what happens and how things work, because there's a guy sitting alone at a desk with his head in his hands for, you know, from 4 to 6 hours a day, living this isolated, intensely private, inwardly directed life. And the product of that penance, almost, you know, that sentence that you're serving, comes out, and it causes certain ripples in the culture. That's wonderful, but that has nothing to do with the guy sitting at the desk, you know. It's out of his hands, beyond his control, and is in a way absolutely not personal. You know what I mean?
I think I know what you mean.
You know, it's like you perform this act, and people then define it and try to make you subscribe to their definitions.
I see what you mean.
And it's, okay. It doesn't really work, you know.
We've talked about your life in the past. Can you describe briefly the kind of life you're living now?
I live in London with my wife and 2 children. I am not a recluse, as a lot of people have imagined. You know, I see a lot of people all the time, and that's pretty much my life.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Michael Hare has been my guest, and his new novel, Walter Winchell, is published by Knopf. He's also the author of Dispatches. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.